for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of podcasting. Welcome to the clubhouse, everyone, and I hope you enjoy today's episode of the Classic English Literature Podcast. We're back in Shakespeare's theater for his plays about Prince Hal, the Henry IV's and Henry V. So order up some fizzy ale, a bit of fruit, nuts, cheese, oysters. The chorus is mounting the stage, and he will tell all. But while he's clearing his throat, I want to send out a special thank you to a listener. Davis, I really appreciate your generous donation to the show. That was great. Folks, Davis was a student of mine years ago, and he's now a wonderful teacher himself. Hey, Davis, if you're still in touch with any of the old gang from Room 309 in the Hawk's Nest, let them know I was asking for them, okay? Oh, the play's beginning. If you think about it, many of Billy the Bard's works dwell upon two main subjects: the problem of kingship and the struggles of parent-child relationships. Fully one-third of his plays draw from English history, and they investigate the actions, values, and characteristics of a monarch. Even beyond the history plays, tragedies like Macbeth or King Lear or Hamlet, they consider the issue. Roman plays, too, like Julius Caesar and Coriolanus. The relations between children and parents, and especially between fathers and sons, similarly dominate. The three aforementioned tragedies, certainly, as well as Othello, but also problematic comedies like Taming of the Shrew or The Merchant of Venice. The sonnets to the fair youth, too, one might argue, have a parental slant. So the plays we'll look at today tackle both of these themes. As a group, the plays now titled Henry IV Parts 1 and 2 and Henry V, along with the preceding Richard II, are sometimes called the Second Tetralogy, the first being the Henry VI plays with Richard III capping that one off. You may have heard the term Henriad, like Homer's Iliad, because these are Shakespeare's historical epic. The term's not really settled. Sometimes it refers to all 8 plays, sometimes just the Second Tetralogy, sometimes just the Henry 4 and 5 plays, which is how I'll be using it in this episode. Some find it easy to see the 3 plays of the Henriad as something of a coming-of-age story for young Henry Plantagenet, usually called Hal before ascending the throne. Henry IV Part 1 opens with King Henry IV, lately Bolingbroke, who deposed Richard II to become the first Lancastrian king, dealing with, in essence, 2 rebellions. Firstly, we have Owen Glendower, a Welsh rebel, and he holds Edmund Mortimer, the king's cousin, hostage, while in the north, Harry Hotspur has sparred with the Earl of Douglas. But while the king struggles to cement his authority, his son and heir, Prince Hal, slums it down in the taverns and brothels of Eastcheap with a rabble of thieves and ne'er-do-wells led by the irrepressible Sir John Falstaff, a fat, lazy, gluttonous, drunken knight who acts as a sort of foster father for the young prince. Political tensions in the north rise, despite the fact that Henry IV admires Hotspur, even to the point of wishing, quote, that it could be proved that some night-tripping fairy had exchanged in cradle clothes our children where they lay, and called mine Percy, his Plantagenet. Then would I have his Harry, and he mine. To find out why Henry kind of covets Harry Hotspur as his own son, listen to Hotspur's speech while arguing with Worcester about why he has the right to keep the prisoners that King Henry demands. Hotspur says, by heaven, methinks it were an easy leap to pluck bright honor from the pale-faced moon or dive into the bottom of the deep, where fathom line could never touch the ground, and pluck up drowned honor by the locks so that he doth redeem her thence might wear without carrival all her dignities. It's this obsession with honor and martial glory that Henry finds wanting in his own son, and maybe, if he's honest, in himself. While Henry laments the great unquietness of his realm, and promises, seriously, I promise, I'm going to do it, he promises to go on crusade, yet he acknowledges his responsibility for the turmoil. Quote, "My blood hath been too cold and temperate, unapt to stir at these indignities, and you have found me, for accordingly you tread upon my patience. But be sure I will from henceforth rather be myself, mighty, and to be feared than my condition, which hath been smooth as oil, soft as young down, and therefore lost that title of respect which the proud soul ne'er pays but to the proud. He's been too soft, too lenient, too merciful, and his underlings and his rivals see this as weakness. No more Mr. Nice Guy." The hardness that Henry feels he must now put on is that which Hal, too, must assume in time to come. The prince is not unaware of this. In the tavern, Hal abandons the elevated blank verse of the royal court and easily speaks the prose of the proles. At the start of Act 4, Hal gives a lengthy discourse on his facility with working-class slang. Quote, "I am so good a proficient in one quarter of an hour that I can drink with any tinker in his own language during my life." He is, to use a modern term, code-switching, you know, adapting his language to his environment. Now, that environment is dominated by Falstaff, perhaps the greatest comic character ever created. Indeed, with only Hamlet as his rival, perhaps the greatest character ever created, full stop. He represents the anti-Henry. He is a force of life, of gusto. His oft-cited rotundity visually reminds us of his boundless appetites. Many point to his origins as the vice character in the old morality plays, or an allegorical representation of the cardinal sins of sloth or gluttony or lust. There is a rather famous scene in the tavern in which Falstaff and Hal roleplay. First Hal playing himself and Falstaff playing the king. Hal demands, tellingly, "Dost thou stand for my father and examine me upon the particulars of my life?"
"Dr. Freud, paging Dr. Freud."
Of course Falstaff stands in for Hal's father. In a parody of the later confrontation between the prince and the king, the two trade witticisms, riposts, and insults, Falstaff taking up his own fabricated worth in the voice of the king. And then they switch roles, and Hal channels his father, heaping abuse on Falstaff slash Hal. Quote, "That villainous, abominable misleader of youth, that old white-bearded Satan." Falstaff replies with what I think is one of the most moving speeches in all of Shakespeare. It's a defense not only of Falstaff himself, but of the joys of life, be they ever so crude and unchivalrous. Quote, "That he is old, the more the pity, his white hairs do witness it. But that he is, saving your reverence, a whoremaster, that I utterly deny. If sack and sugar be a fault, God help the wicked. If to be old and merry be a sin, then many an old host that I know is damned. If to be fat is to be hated, then Pharaoh's lean kine are to be loved. No, my good lord, banish Peto, banish Bardolph, banish Poins. But for sweet Jack Falstaff, kind Jack Falstaff, true Jack Falstaff, valiant Jack Falstaff, and therefore more valiant being as he is old Jack Falstaff, banish not him thy Harry's company. Banish not him thy Harry's company. Banish plump Jack, and banish all the world." Banish all the world, all that for which we live. Yes, he's a rascal, a liar, a thief, and a drunkard. But he is life, right? He is human life and all its exuberance. Hal's response, it never fails to utterly chill me. Quote, I do. I will. It's just devastating. Hal will continue to squander his time in the Boar's Head Tavern with Falstaff and company, but he's already revealed to us his cunning plan. It's a bit of a long speech, but it's crucial to an understanding of the play's view of kingship and sonship. Quote, I know you all, and will a while uphold the unyoked humor of your idleness. Yet herein will I imitate the sun, who doth permit the base, contagious clouds to smother up his beauty from the world, that when he please again to be himself, being wanted, he may be more wondered at, by breaking through the foul and ugly mists of vapors that did seem to strangle him. If all the year were playing holidays, disport would be as tedious as to work, but when they seldom come, they wished for come. And nothing pleaseth but rare accidents. So when this loose behavior I throw off and pay the debt I never promised, by how much better than my word I am, by so much shall I falsify men's hopes, and, like bright metal on a sullen ground, my reformation, glittering o'er my fault, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off. I'll so offend to make offense a skill, redeeming time when men think least I will. So Hal's performing a kind of public relations jujitsu. He's using his father's displeasure as a means of crafting an image of redemptive monarchy. You know, it is crafty. It's manipulative. And it shows, I think, kind of a coolness in Hal's character. There's a calculation here. At the end of the play, Hal indeed seems to have made good his promise. At the Battle of Shrewsbury, the prince offers to stand in single combat against Hotspur. Now, by the way, this is ahistorical. They never met on the battlefield, and the historical Hotspur was significantly older than Hal. But, you know, it makes for great drama, no? Hal confesses his backsliding. Quote, for my part, I may speak it to my shame, I have a truant been to chivalry, and so I hear he doth account me too. Yet this before my father's majesty, I am content that he shall take the odds of his great name in estimation, and will, to save the blood on either side, try fortune with him in a single fight. The king consents, despite his reservations, because he's just so proud of his big boy. But note again Hal's performance. I get the feeling that he's playing his father here. And I don't believe for a second that he actually feels ashamed of his past frolics with Falstaff's gang. This is the moment of his glorification, when Falstaff becomes the sullen ground from which the Prince of Wales glitteringly ascends. Now, the Fat Knight gives his famous catechism at the battle, a speech that highlights the contrast between his own clear-eyed realism, Hotspur's chivalric idealism, and Henry/Hal's rather cool pragmatism. Falstaff says, what is honor? A word. What is in that word honor? What is that honor? Air. A trim reckoning. Who hath it? He that died a Wednesday. Doth he feel it? No. Doth he hear it? No. 'Tis insensible then. Yea, to the dead. But will it not live with the living? No. Why? Detraction will not suffer it. Therefore, I'll none of it. Honor is a mere scutcheon. The image of the scutcheon, it's from heraldry, the coat of arms. It's particularly apt, right? It's an appearance, a means of identification only valued by those who subscribe to the ethic that the symbol points to. Like Tinkerbell and the fairies, it only exists if you believe it does. And this is why I think Falstaff survives. This is why Hal is victorious, and this is why Hotspur must die. Of course, right, Hal defeats Hotspur. But they get separated in the battle. Falstaff comes upon the corpse, stabs it with his own sword, and claims the kill. And Hal abides by the fraud, telling the old man, quote, "If a lie may do thee grace, I'll gild it with the happiest terms I have." Later, the prince tells Lancaster how he has learned to, quote, "cherish such high deeds." The juxtaposition here is telling. You know, he'll cover up a lie on the one hand, but then he's talking about how he cherishes nobility and high deeds. He's a politician playing to the crowd. He's an actor. Expediency is Hal's watchword. And so, you know, the prodigal son returns, I guess. Except that in the biblical parable, the errant child learns his lesson and throws himself upon the mercy of a loving father. Here, the prodigality was calculated, calibrated for maximum political effect. Hal does not learn a lesson over the course of the play. He always knew it, and he knew that, in the service of the monarchy, his father's and soon enough his own, he must sacrifice Falstaff and the commoners in order to lead them. He can only be among them, never of them. And that becomes more evident on the fields before Agincourt. Henry IV, Part 1, ends somewhat ambiguously, or at least without clear resolution. Father and son ride off into the sunset to quell all rebellion in the land, as the violins swell and the brass blares a fanfare, for they, quote, "will not leave till all our own be won." Go get 'em, boys. The play was so successful, indeed, the most popular published play by Shakespeare in the 1590s. That by 1599 he had to pen a sequel, one that he probably had not intended when the first play concluded. Much of the popular demand centered on Falstaff. The punters wanted more of the fat knight. So the playwright largely repeated the structure in Part 2 that had served him so well in Part 1. Hal seems once again to have fallen into dissolute ways, distancing himself from his father's court, but engineering his Phoenix Rising from the Ashes Act, again, Falstaff gratifies with witty speeches. The popularity of his sidekick Pistol was such that the ensign made it onto the title page, clearly as a draw for the audience. So good for him. So despite providing a vehicle for Falstaff, and Shakespeare will do it again with a play called The Merry Wives of Windsor, a comedy rumored to have been ordered by Queen Elizabeth herself. But it presents a much diminished Falstaff. He's like a caricature of the Henriade character. And the play does bequeath us a couple of quite famous lines, like, quote, "He hath eaten me out of house and home," and, quote, "Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown." But other than that, the play is really kind of dwarfed by its predecessor and its successor. Hal becomes king by the end of this one, though, and offers a chilling line that neatly sums up his rise to the throne and eerily predicts the nature of his reign. In his final casting off of Falstaff, the new king says, quote, "I know thee not, old man," finishing, quote, "Presume not that I am the thing I was." Wow. The final play in the trilogy, The Life of King Henry V, is very much misnamed, I think. Really, the play focuses on the events surrounding the Battle of Agincourt in the autumn of 1415, and then Henry's marriage to Princess Catherine. Shakespeare's primary source here, in addition to the reliable Holingshed, is an older anonymous play from perhaps the late 1580s called The Famous Victories of Henry V. Actually, Shakespeare poached events from this play for the entire Henriad. Here we see the fully mature Hal as Henry V, the martial monarch. In the prologue, the chorus refers to him as, quote, warlike Harry, like himself, assuming the bearing of Mars, the god of war. Now that phrase is interesting, sort of a doubly redundant, ambiguous simile or something, I don't know. Harry is warlike, a warrior king. Okay, got it. But the allusion to Mars makes warlike also comparative, like war itself. Harry personifies war. So he's not just warrior, he is war. I don't know. And then the phrase like himself means something like, I don't know, like impersonating himself by being authentically himself, by being like Mars. I don't know. At any rate, he is no longer playing the dissolute prince. But he is rather touchy when other people bring it up. Now, early in the play, the bishops of Canterbury and Ely hope to maneuver the king into a renewed conflict with France over Henry's claim to that country's crown. And this, they hope, will distract the young king from an issue with church revenues. Ha ha ha. We are treated to long and fawning speeches by these guys. They describe Salic law, the airtightness of Henry's claim through Edward III, and they appeal to his honor and image. Lord Exeter helps out, saying, quote, "Your brother kings and monarchs of the earth do all expect that you should rouse yourself, as did the former lions of your blood." You know, it's all so over the top. It's so exaggerated. These guys are giving speeches that far outlast any theatrical or dramatic necessity. I think Shakespeare is just pouring it on. This is satire almost. And I think the crafty young monarch sees through them. It seems to me he teases them about his reservations, you know, including, granted, the very serious threat of Scotland invading. But nonetheless, Henry feels a bit reticent. And he has demanded that any military expedition be predicated upon unimpeachable evidence. Quote, "And God forbid, my dear and faithful lord, that you should fashion, rest, or bow your reading, or nicely charge your understanding soul with opening titles miscreate, whose right suits not in native colors with the truth. For God doth know how many now in health shall drop their blood in approbation of what your reverence shall incite us to. Therefore take heed how you impawn our person, how you awake our sleeping sword of war. We charge you in the name of God, take heed." So he is conscious that a claim exists and that he should, by right and tradition, exercise that claim, but only if it's honorable. Then, ambassadors from France come with a message from the Dauphin and a gift, some treasure. The Dauphin of France has sent King Henry of England tennis balls. Tennis balls. The king is enraged by this insulting allusion to his playful youth, especially made by one too thick to see its purposes. Quote, "We understand him well. How he comes o'er us with our wilder days, not measuring what use we made of them." Hal then commits to invading France. Quote, "I will rise there with so full of glory that I will dazzle all the eyes of France. Yea, strike the Dauphin blind to look on us, and tell the pleasant prince this mock of his hath turned his balls to gunstones. And his soul shall stand sore charged for the wasteful vengeance that shall fly with them. For many a thousand widows shall this his mock out of their dear husbands, mock mothers from their sons, mock castles down. And some are yet ungotten and unborn that shall have cause to curse the Dauphin's scorn." Doesn't he sound like a little bit like Hotspur here? Wow, he holds the Dauphin fully responsible for the terror the English army will unleash upon the French people and countryside, a wave of destruction that will torment those not yet born. It's a hellish speech. And it's not the only one. On his campaign before the gates of Harfleur, he demands the city's immediate surrender or, quote, I will not leave the half-achieved Harfleur till in her ashes she lie buried. The gates of mercy shall be all shut up, and the fleshed soldier, rough and hard of heart, in liberty of bloody hand, shall range with conscience wide as hell, mowing like grass your fresh virgins and your flowering infants. Whoa! Even on the battlefield, such language strikes us as shocking. The graphic, almost indulgent threat of physical, sexual, and moral violence against a civilian population is just repulsive. Or is this more theater? Would Henry actually make good on such threats in the case of Harfleur's resistance? Well, I mean, don't know, but I wouldn't bet on his forbearance. At Agincourt, when he hears of the arrival of French reinforcements, he commits what then was a violation of chivalry, and today would be a war crime. He orders the execution of all French prisoners. Quote, but hark, what new alarm is this same? The French have reinforced their scattered men. Then every soldier kill his prisoners. Give the word through. Even the enduringly famous, once more unto the breach, dear friends, once more, or close the wall up with our English dead. It's a pep talk urging his soldiers to close the line with their corpses. The cry God for Harry, England, and St. George is very stirring, though. I kind of like that. And, you know, of course, the St. Crispin's Day speech. Oh my God. Is there a better piece of martial oratory? The answer, by the way, is no, there isn't. Quote, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so vile. This day shall gentle his condition, and gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. Ooh. Harry is no doubt an effective war leader and rhetorician. And he plays the populist note here, right? That he is one of the vile, the peasant class, or that they are of him. It is the gentlemen abed in England who lack nobility. You know, today's political rhetoric pitting the elites against the, you know, real people, usually by leaders with all the elite accoutrement, is a baser version of Harry's rousing exhortation. I don't know. Perhaps I've gone far enough in pointing to Henry's performative politics. I admit I risk reducing Shakespeare's rich characterization to a conniving opportunist, and I don't think he's that. He is, as he will say, a man, and one with vulnerabilities and blind spots. One of the more famous scenes occurs at the beginning of Act 4. On the eve of battle, Harry is troubled in his conscience, so he dons a cloak and anonymously moves about the camp, listening to his men speak about their fates. Okay, but yeah, the secret cloak thing does seem still a bit performative, but bear with. He comes upon a sentry named Michael Williams, who challenges him. The king, pretending to be a common soldier, tries to put his own case for the justness of the coming battle, using ambiguous phrases such as, I think the king is but a man as I am, which is at best tautological, right? And he says, I will speak my conscience of the king. I think he would not wish himself anywhere but where he is. But Williams... And note that Shakespeare gives this interlocutor a name, an identity. He's not just, you know, Soldier 3 or Crossbow Fodder 2. We have a man speaking here, questioning the honor of the king's enterprise. And he says, quote, but if the cause be not good, the king himself hath a heavy reckoning to make, when all those legs and arms and heads chopped off in a battle shall join together at the latter day and cry all, we died at such a place. Some swearing, some crying for a surgeon, some upon their wives left poor behind them. some upon the debts they owe, some upon their children rawly left. I'm afeard there are few die well that die in battle, for how can they charitably dispose of anything when blood is their argument? Now, if these men do not die well, it will be a black matter for the king that led them to it, who to disobey were against all proportion of subjection. Williams directly confronts the kind of rhetoric Harry uses to intimidate his enemies and spur on his soldiers. Williams points out the emptiness of such nationalistic bloviation, the callousness of these images of death when the human reality behind those images gets lost in the haze of patriotic or egotistical fervor. When Williams and the other soldiers leave, Henry gives a soliloquy that shows, sadly, how little he has absorbed in his time with the common men. He pities himself for the burden of greatness, echoing his father's, "Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown." And he longs for the simple, pleasant life of the mindless peasant, since those who rule cannot, quote, "sleep so soundly as the wretched slave who, with a body filled and vacant mind, gets him to rest crammed with distressful bread. Never sees horrid night the child of hell, but like a lackey, from the rise to set, sweats in the eye of Phoebus, and all night sleeps in Elysium." Were you even listening, man? Those men are not sleeping soundly. They see the horrid night. Occasionally, when some tabloid or website needs a listicle to kill up some space, somebody will put out a poll asking for England's most popular ruler in history. And Henry V usually occupies a slot close to the top, usually below Good Queen Bess and Richard the Lionheart, but still respectable, though his reign is quite brief and the country plunges into civil war soon after his death. I think what explains his continued popularity, or at least what contributes to an explanation for it, is the image created by Laurence Olivier in the 1944 film version of Henry V. Olivier gives us a consummate hero king in wartime. Certainly a necessity, you know, a bit of spirit raising during the Second World War. And by excising some of the play's less flattering portrayals of Henry, we get the version of him to rouse the patriotic blood. But to mistake Shakespeare's character for Olivier's interpretation is a mistake. Henry is an effective and successful king, but I don't think he's an admirable man. People often like to speak of his trajectory over the course of the three plays as a maturation, a coming of age, or as a redemption. But I must reject the first proposition. Hal always was who he was. He did not grow so much as was strategically revealed. And the second proposition, I believe, can only be seen as ironic. Far from being a jingoistic pep rally, though, yes, okay, Billy the Bard doesn't often miss an opportunity to ridicule the French. Gotta say that. The Henriad becomes, by the end, a satire of nationalism. The chorus points that out. A king cannot be both successful and good. But note that Shakespeare never judges Hal. While there may be less approbation than we are wont to recall, there is no condemnation. Hal must do what he does because the stability of his realm requires it. We've mentioned the Italian political philosopher Niccolò Machiavelli before, whose 1513 The Prince dismisses utopian political fantasies as, you know, utopian fantasies. He introduces to the modern world the concept of realpolitik, that is, a politics focused on practical strategies that will lead to desired results given the political realities of the time. This rather than focusing on moral or ideological considerations. Now, this amorality in the exercise of power led to the theatrical trope of the Machiavel, characters like Richard III or Lorenzo from the Spanish tragedy, you know, whose ruthless ambition in the pursuit of power came to be associated with Machiavelli himself. But this is an error. I mean, yes, Machiavelli urged expediency at the expense of morality if necessary, but not to gratify personal ambition. Rather, for Machiavelli, the stability of the state was of the utmost concern. To maintain power so that the state may thrive is the first duty of the prince, and in the service of this imperative, ethical considerations must give way. So, looked at like this, Henry V is Machiavellian without being a Machiavel. Indeed, perhaps has committed his entire life from the taverns of Eastcheap to Westminster to the fields of France, he's devoted all that for the preservation of England. Oh, wow, this has been a long one, hasn't it, folks? Sorry if I have taxed your patience. Thank you very much for listening. You know, please follow all the social media stuff, drop an email, hit the support the show button, tell your friends, yada, yada, yada. Have a good time until next time.